Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor. I'm the RSA's Chief Executive. It's my great pleasure to welcome you here this evening. Before we begin, can you make sure your mobile phone is switched to silent? We're filming tonight and live streaming over the web, so welcome to everyone watching online. A reminder that the hashtag, if you want to contribute to the conversation remotely or from this room, is RSA, hashtag RSA Democracy. Now, housekeeping notice is over. I'm delighted to introduce this evening's speaker, Andrea Leadsom. Andrea is Member of Parliament for South and Northamptonshire, was elected to the Commons in 2010. After serving on the Treasury Select Committee, she's held roles as City Minister, Minister of State at the Department of Energy and Climate Change, and Secretary of State for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. In June 2017, Andrea was made President of the Council and Leader of the House of Commons. As leader, Andrea represents government in Parliament and Parliament in government. She is the Cabinet Minister responsible for overseeing the progress of government legislation through Parliament. Every Thursday, when the Commons is sitting, she answers questions on the business of the House. As leader, she is responsible for procedural changes, and following recent claims of sexual harassment in Westminster, it was she who chaired a cross-party working group on an independent grievance and complaints policy. In her speech this evening, Andrea will share some of the lessons of this process, explore the particular challenges and opportunities for Parliament posed by the digital age, and set out her views on what both say about our wider political culture. In this Vote 100 year, as we celebrate the centenary of the 1918 Representation of the People Act, and as Parliament prepares for the return of powers from the European Union, can we really say our democracy is as vital and inclusive as the suffragettes sought to make it? And if not, what can we do about it? I'll be joining Andrea later on stage to lead the conversation in response to her speech, and there'll be plenty of time for you to pose your questions too. So now please join me in welcoming Andrea Leadsom on Strengthening Our Parliamentary Democracy.
Well, thanks very much, Matthew. I'm number 336, and you might wonder, what on earth does that mean? Well, I'm actually the 336th female MP ever in the United Kingdom. And just to put that in perspective, there are 442 male MPs in this Parliament alone. So in a sense, we're doing incredibly well, and in another sense, we've got an awfully long way to go. And 100 years ago, of course, it would not have been possible for me to be standing here as Leader of the Commons, let alone as an MP. But thanks to the sacrifices of the women who came before, we won the right to vote and eventually to stand as parliamentary candidates. The suffragettes and the suffragists made huge sacrifices. Women were imprisoned. Women were humiliated in public and at home. Women endured hunger strikes. And women even paid the ultimate price, women like Emily Wilding Davison. So from the first women in the world to get the vote in New Zealand, to those who just picked us to the post in some states in the United States, this was a long global fight, but it was a fight that changed the world. And so a century later, we can feel proud of the progress we've made in the UK as we remember the struggle and the achievements. But I think we're also reminded of how far we have to go to achieve true equality. And when we think of democracy, it's very easy to think of it as just voting, but it's about so much more than that. Democracy today is a society that hears every voice, considers every view, and counts every hand. Democracy is encouraging open dialogue and embracing rather than recoiling from our differing views. So 100 years since women got, well, since some women in the UK got the vote, can we really say that our democracy is as equal as those women sought to make it? Well, I think not. Democracy is not something we can take for granted. And there's a growing concern about democratic backsliding right across the world. Wherever you are, whatever your political context, democracy is something that requires nurturing all the time. And in recent years, something in our own politics has shifted. Aggression and intolerance are on the rise. Social media presents a really challenging battleground. And as the Prime Minister recognised in her recent speech on standards in public life, public debate is coarsening. To paraphrase Thomas Jefferson, the third US president, the democracy we get is the democracy we deserve. And that means that if we collectively fail to tackle discrimination, bullying, and attempted censorship, then we cannot be surprised when the health of our democracy suffers. We must not be complacent, ever. So in this centenary year, we have to ask ourselves, where will we be in another 100 years? Well, to begin with, in the spirit of the suffrage movement, we must continue the fight to achieve a 50-50 parliament. And we're still falling very sadly short of that target. And just as importantly is to achieve an intersectional parliament, one that recognises our diversity of race, religion and gender in the United Kingdom. And the question is, how do we get there? We cannot just assume that we're heading in the right direction and wait to see what happens. We will only realise these challenges through positive action. So this evening, whilst I am very proud of our democracy, I want to talk about three areas that I think we have to look at very closely over the coming years if we want to have a democracy that really works for all of us. Firstly is participation, particularly supporting young people to engage with politics and making sure everyone uses their voice and their vote. Second is e-democracy. How can we make sure that the digital world, this extraordinary change in everything around us, is compatible with a fair and open democracy? And thirdly, something very close to home for me, is securing a parliament fit for the 21st century, a parliament that is the best workplace in the world. So I'll come to each of these in turn, but I want to start by looking at participation in democracy, and where better to look than in the recent referendums. The Scottish independence referendum saw an incredible turnout of 84.6%, to be followed not long after by the EU referendum with a very impressive 77.2% turnout. These decisions will change the future and shape the future of our United Kingdom, and the huge interest they attracted should be celebrated. And then the 2017 general election was seen as a game changer for the role of young people in elections. Over a million under 25s made voter registration applications, 34% of the total, in the run-up to the 2017 election. This helped increase the size of the electoral register to 46.8 million electors, which is a record. Nevertheless, young people continue to be underrepresented in our democratic processes, including on the electoral register. YouGov estimate that at the 2017 election, only 57% of 18 to 19-year-olds voted, compared with 84% of those aged over 70. Research by the British Election Study also suggests that the youthquake, so-called, wasn't as seismic as first reported, putting the turnout figure at somewhere in the region of 50%. So whilst youth engagement appears to be at its highest in 25 years, turnout remains comparatively low, and actually especially when compared with other European countries. And recent research shows that young people in the UK are interested in politics, broadly defined, but have turned to alternative forms of democratic engagement, from consumer politics to community campaigns, rather than engaging in what might be seen as more formal politics. Evidence suggests that this could be due to a lack of knowledge and awareness of how and why young people should participate in our democracy. Well, we must do better. Voting is the ultimate act of protest. And by that, I don't mean casting a protest vote. I mean voting, full stop. As we've seen in the recent referendums and recent elections, it does matter and it does make a difference. And when I hear people saying to me on the doorstep, ah, you're all the same, won't make a difference, I'm not going to bother to vote, I just have to remind them, look at the changes over recent decades. Look at the fundamental way in which political change has created societal change. You cannot possibly argue that voting for you versus you simply doesn't make a difference. It does. Voting sends a very powerful message. It has the ability to change everything, and it's entirely yours to cast. As the leading American suffragette Carrie Chapman Catt said in 1920, the vote is the emblem of your equality. And those words ring true to this day. That's why the government is so committed to building a more inclusive democracy. We recognise that every voice matters is an issue of social justice, and we're working towards making our elections the most accessible ever by 2022. So I want to pay tribute to the Minister for the Constitution, Chloe Smith, and her predecessor, Chris Skidmore, for their work to tackle democratic engagement by modernising electoral registration, to strengthen the integrity of our electoral system through a series of measures to tackle election fraud, and to promote this summer's inaugural National Democracy Week, which will act as a focal point for promoting democratic engagement. And I also want to praise Parliament's own efforts to reach out beyond the walls of the Palace of Westminster. I hope everyone here, at the very least, will get involved in November when this year's Parliament Week takes place, an annual festival that seeks to inform people about Parliament and empowers them to get involved, encourages them to use their vote. And then in my own role as Leader of the Commons, I've got my own little outreach programmes. I've loved being able to get involved with the Youth Parliament and to visit a number of schools and universities, to take part in Votes for Schools, which is a great organisation that encourages young people to debate and to voice their opinions. The 2018 audit of political engagement by the Hansard Society will be published on Monday, and that will show that progress is being made, with a significant improvement over the period of the audit in the percentage saying that they are certain to vote. This headline figure is encouraging, but the audit also shows that underlying issues remain. Many continue to take a dim view of the efficacy of our political system. In other words, they just don't feel that if they get involved, it will make much of a difference. And that is a challenge for all of us. And doing more to ensure our public space for debate is as inclusive as possible is a critical first step. People deserve to feel that their voice will not just be heard, but it will also be respected. Creating an equal space for participation and debate falls to all of us, and not just the government. So universities are a beacon for discussion, and we're lucky that the UK is home to 12 of the world's top 100 universities, including the world's number one and number two. But recently, we've heard worrying reports by online forum The Student Room that a third of students have experienced racism on campus. And a shocking report by the National Union for Students claiming that sexual misconduct by university staff is rife. As institutions that thrive on free speech and inclusion, universities are in many ways a testing ground for the state of our democracy. Nobody should be silenced because of their race or gender, and we cannot let anything of this sort go unchallenged. Because what becomes acceptable in a liberal environment like our colleges or universities soon becomes acceptable in wider society. So whilst ensuring that they remain bastions of free speech, these institutions must do more to expel all forms of racism, sexism, homophobia, and any religious intolerance from their campuses. Because to feel shut out from a lecture or from a debate is to be shut out from democracy. Our experiences as individuals through our education should encourage us to make our voices heard once we've left school and university, including at the ballot box. But having set that rather gloomy picture, I think what we cannot doubt, any of us, is the enthusiasm and engagement of young people in political issues. And for that, we can't ignore the role that's being played by the internet. From blogging to campaign videos, the internet has revolutionised the way people interact with politicians and Parliament, and it has in many ways been a force for good. Over half of 12 to 15-year-olds who are interested in the news get their updates from social media, compared with only 17% who read a newspaper. The web has also made previously opaque processes far more accessible. Take voter registration or e-petitions. Just two examples where digitalisation has made democratic engagement easier and quicker. In its first year of operation, the current petition system for Parliament has seen over 10 million unique email addresses used to sign petitions in the UK. And the topics for petitions are hugely varied, ranging from what should be on the national schools curriculum through to animal rights issues and foreign policy. And all political parties understand the value of social media for communicating to their supporters. But whilst there is much to embrace, we are in danger of allowing the internet to provide an unregulated free-for-all, with serious consequences for our society, such as the harmful impact of data protection breaches and the way this erodes trust in the system. The proliferation of fake news. We've even seen a trend of selective reporting on debates in the Commons, like that on animal sentience. Such cases prove that a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth has the chance to put its boots on. And of course, there is the constant abuse from internet trolls. We heard only last week the appalling anti-Semitic abuse suffered by Jewish colleagues in Parliament, with social media being used as the most common vehicle for spreading that abuse. And I'm also concerned by websites that publish details of debates and votes that only tell half the story. I know plenty of MPs who've been sent abusive emails from their constituents because websites such as They Work For You have reported them as missing a vote. What these websites don't tell you, however, is whether an MP is away from Parliament because they've just become a parent, or they were paired with another Member of Parliament because they're away on select committee business, perhaps looking into the plight of the Rohingya, or even if they're attending to a constituency crisis, perhaps a flood or something dramatic that's happening in their constituency that requires them to be away from Parliament. So these are crucial parts of the puzzle when it comes to the accurate reporting of what goes on in Parliament. And unfortunately, it's a slippery slope. The kind of abuse that colleagues get can turn to trolling, and trolling has driven some of my colleagues offline. And in the worst cases, as we know, parliamentarians have also been victims of violent crime. A recent report by the Westminster Foundation for Democracy found that 44% of female parliamentarians from 39 different countries around the world, 44% of them have received death threats or threats of rape, assault, or abduction. 44% of them. And the government's own Internet Safety Green Paper, published last October, noted there is much anecdotal evidence that online abuse and hate crime can silence the voices of women, BAME, faith, disabled, and LGBT communities who feel that they have to remove themselves from certain platforms and discussions in order to stay safe. How can this be the case in 21st century Britain? The Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sport has proposed introducing a social media code of practice, transparency reporting and a social media levy, which will, all of these steps will help in our goal of achieving Britain to become the safest place in the world to be online. But of course, at the moment, we are a very long way away from achieving that. And also the government's response to the Committee on Standards in Public Life report, which was commissioned by the Prime Minister, outlines a comprehensive set of actions. And this includes a review of offensive communications by the Law Commission, making sure that what is illegal offline is also illegal online. But of course, equal participation in our democracy is not just a problem for our online spaces. The wave of sexual misconduct allegations and the Me Too movement soon reached the door of Parliament. For too long, a culture of bullying, harassment, and sexual harassment has gone unchecked in Westminster. And it's no wonder that out of fear of being hounded, out of fear of being called a liar, or out of fear of being ignored, victims so often stay silent. That silence erodes the democratic participation of too many people, particularly women. And in Westminster, we have so far failed to set the best example. What we urgently need is a parliament fit for the 21st century. And following last November's allegations, the Prime Minister acted quickly. She asked me to chair a working group to tackle allegations of bullying, harassment, and sexual harassment, and to implement strong procedures to handle complaints and grievances. And I can tell you this was by no means easy. With seven political parties involved, plus staff representatives, there were a huge number of broadly differing views on how best to achieve our aims. I was reminded quite regularly by very committed and talented colleagues right across the House that we've tried this before and it didn't work then, so it's not going to work now. I think you all know the score. So it was a groundbreaking moment for Parliament when the recommendations of the Working Group's report were actually approved by the Commons, the Lords, and the House of Commons Commission. And there will now be radical changes that will fundamentally change Parliament for the better. Work is urgently underway to establish a behaviour code that will cover all those working in or visiting Parliament. Independent services that will investigate cases of bullying and of sexual harassment with the appropriate support and confidentiality provided for each. A new set of sanctions that will be made available to the Parliamentary Commissioners for Standards who deal with complaints against MPs and peers. And vitally, the confidentiality that will give victims the courage to come forward. And it's my hope that by creating an independent complaints process with proper sanctions, this will not only provide the much-needed support to those who've been treated badly, but it will also help to create the culture change we want to see, where everyone working in or visiting Parliament is treated with dignity and respect. Since publication of my report, we've heard further worrying allegations about bullying of House staff by members of Parliament. And it's become clear that the respect policy that was meant to protect staff of the House of Commons is just not working for them as it should. So I was very pleased recently that my recommendation to the House Commission for an independent inquiry into the bullying of House staff was approved and that it's now being taken forward under the independent chairmanship of Dame Laura Cox QC. There can be no hiding places or cover-ups for anyone found to be abusing their power. It is the dream job of so many to work in Parliament and in politics, whether as an MP, whether as a researcher, whether as a parliamentary clerk, of course as a peer, or of those staff who work in the House to support everything that we do. All of those people are coming into Parliament essentially to help make our world a better place. That's the ambition that we share. And so we owe it to them and to the next generation of politicians, staffers and campaigners to make Parliament a great place to work. As I've said many times, it is a right, not a privilege, to be treated with respect. And I'm committed to making our Parliament a fair and safe place for everybody. So before I finish, I want to return briefly to the question I posed at the start. Is our democracy as equal as the suffrage movement sought to make it? Their achievement was the moment when some women were given the vote, paving the way for universal suffrage in the following decade. The franchise is now a fundamental part of our democracy, and it is vital. But as I hope I've made clear this evening, democracy is about more than just voting. A democracy that works for all is one where each voter is confident to express themselves in public debate. Each voter is confident their views will be represented without fear or favour in Parliament by their Member of Parliament. And each voter believes that they will not be subject to abuse or intimidation. It's clear that the UK has a lot to do to safeguard our democracy from what are new, emerging, and in many cases, uncharted threats. That's why I conclude where I started, with those who refuse to accept the political status quo 100 years ago. I'm inspired by the suffragists and their determination to achieve change. And we should be energised by their example of seeking the political culture we want to see, not the one we have today. We should never forget how lucky we are to live in a country that gives us a vote. And we must do everything we can to protect that, including making equality itself an emblem of our democracy. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. There was a lot in that. And I'll ask a few questions and then we'll open it up. I said at the beginning, introducing you, that the part of your role is, as it were, to represent Parliament to government and government to Parliament. I'm interested in the extent to which this means that you will tend to find yourself on the side of those people arguing for a stronger role for Parliament. So we have one very long ongoing debate about that, which is around Brexit, and more recently we've had the particular issue of Syria. Is it? Do you see it as your role in those kinds of debates to be someone saying we need to maximise the role that Parliament can play in these important decisions?
Yes, very much so. The argument, I think, around leaving the EU is a perfect example of that, because not only do we have no real majority in the House of Commons, but also we have an enormous amount of interest and controversy surrounding the decision that was taken by the UK public, and therefore we have a duty to listen to all voices, to hear all offers to strengthen and improve the legislation. And if anybody is geek enough to follow the EU withdrawal bill from start to finish, they will see that it has dramatically changed. Many of the measures in it have been significantly changed as a result of the interventions by way of amendments or by way of discussions right across both houses and all parties. So yes, in answer to your question, my role is to ensure that people's voices are heard in the big issues such as the legislation that withdraws us from the European Union, but also in the day-to-day issues. So for example, a number of issues are being raised with me at the moment about the rise in knife crime in Parliament. And many colleagues are concerned about that. And so I've undertaken to try to allocate government time to give a debate on that so that colleagues can come forward with their suggestions and ideas. And other areas such as private members' bills, where in this Parliament we're really seeking to support as many private members' bills as we can, because that is giving the opportunity to backbenchers in a Parliament where there isn't a real majority to be able to have their legislation heard and supported by government wherever that is sensible to do so.
And do you worry at all that in the kind of discourse around leaving the European Union, what one often hears is that when people want Parliament to play a bigger role, to have greater capacity to shape the outcome, that there is a kind of drumbeat which is, well, this is Parliament defying the people. And that argument is often used, and often used quite kind of passionately. Do you have any concerns about what that is implicitly saying about our representative democracy? That in some senses we are establishing the idea that direct democracy, what the voters decide, whether it's in a referendum or at elections actually, that that is sacrosanct, and that the role of representative is never to defy what the public decide at those moments of voting? Because that, I mean, ever since Edmund Burke, we've been having this kind of debate, but implicit in that argument is that representative democracy should be seen very much as being kind of a subsidiary, or simply there to implement or to guess and then implement the voters' wishes.
I mean, that's a really big philosophical debate, and as an ex-student of politics, I could get right into that. I mean, it's a fascinating subject, and perhaps not. I might switch off our audience, but seriously, I do think that the whole issue around referenda and where they are appropriate, and you know, there is a sort of a general sense that they're appropriate in issues of constitutional matters, but not in day-to-day issues. And interestingly, as a constituency MP, I will get letters or emails generally from constituents saying, as my MP, I require you to turn up to this debate and vote this way on it. Now, I sort of am tempted to sort of write back and say, well, have a word with the other 82,000 of my electors, and if you've all agreed, then I'll consider it. Because, of course, there is this issue of, are you there to represent, in other words, to use your best own intelligent thought around what's best for your constituents, taking into account their views, or are you simply there to do as they told you to do in all circumstances? And then, of course, there are the issues around protecting your country versus protecting your constituency, and versus, in the end, protecting your party. So I think these are huge issues, and at the moment...
Don't you get the sense that if you're on kind of the bear pit of question time or something like that, if somebody says, look, I'm here to do what the voters want, everyone goes, yeah. So if someone was to say, well, actually, I'm not necessarily here to do what the voters want if I think the voters are stupid. You know, my job is to use my judgment. I know more than a lot of voters know about complex issues, and I'm going to do what I think is my ethical responsibility, which is to vote in the way that I think is right, even if it sometimes means defying the great British public. That, to say that feels like a very brave thing to do nowadays.
I don't think you'd find many politicians calling the public stupid. And I don't think you'd find many politicians thinking the public was stupid either, actually. I mean, it is astonishing. You know, people do tend to say, well, there's no point talking to you because you won't take any notice. But actually, very genuinely, some of the best ideas, some of the best insights have been knocking on doors, just going around saying, hi, I'm your MP, is there anything you want to raise with me? You hear some extraordinarily insightful things that really do colour your views. So I think that the idea that the public are always wrong or always right is just obviously not accurate. The role of a representative is to do what they think is the right thing to do, taking into account all of the features around it. So I happen to think that the decision of the referendum, whether it be on Scottish independence or leaving the European Union, both must be upheld. Those were very clear decisions in both cases with a significant majority, and therefore I think that context is set. But I think what possibly you're getting at is it right to accuse colleagues who are just appearing to want us to stay in a customs union or whatever it might be? Is that outrageous? No, of course it's not outrageous. And for me, as the leader of the Commons, I do try to reach out to all colleagues of all views to make clear that their views are very important. Where we can, where it's not scuppering our fulfilling the will of the people to leave the European Union, where it's improving the legislation, improving the transparency, the accountability, then we do try and take it into account.
So you wouldn't have much sympathy for the kind of enemies of the people type headlines that imply...
No. No, absolutely not. No. Not even in the case of the House of Lords, which has been quite topical this week. Yeah.
Now, one of the challenges, it seems to me, about our system is that when we talk about democracy and we talk about the values you talked about this evening, it's difficult not to feel a kind of warmth about that, about those ideas. But, of course, what lives in the democratic space is politics, the real world of politics. And sometimes the way that politics works jars quite a lot with the kind of principles we establish for democracy. So to take one example, if Theresa May were to resign tomorrow... The Prime Minister for the next 3 years, who would have an enormous amount of power in this country, would be chosen by, most people estimate, about 70,000 members of the Conservative Party now, with an average age of around 70 as well. I mean, it's quite hard to square the big principles you described with such a peculiar kind of idea that such a tiny, deeply unrepresentative group of people would ultimately choose somebody to have as much power as the Prime Minister has in our system.
Well, I would encourage everybody to join the Conservative Party to significantly improve the voter base under those circumstances. I mean, you make a very good point, and if you study all electoral systems, you know, I'm going to resort to that line of, well, this is the best of a bad lot. So, you know, there's no perfect system. And, you know, if you go back to sort of Roman days where you tried to sort of be very directly accountable to the people, that didn't work terribly well either. So I genuinely do think that we continue at all times to consider these things. And of course, when you get a sitting Prime Minister resign, there are issues around who takes over and what the electoral base is for them. But that is one of the ways in which our electoral system works. And the beauty of it is it's not too long before you do have another opportunity to have a general election for the people to express their wishes again. So, I mean, I genuinely feel we are so fortunate to have a largely uncorrupt and one person, one vote system in this country that we must do everything we can to preserve and enhance. You know, so we need to take measures to protect against electoral fraud. We need to take measures to encourage more people to vote. But at the same time, we do need to accept no system is going to be perfect.
Now, I don't want to abuse my position as chair to advertise a speech I'm going to be making, but I am actually going to do that. So I'm giving my annual lecture in July, and the focus of that annual lecture will be on something which we haven't talked about at all so far, because we talked about direct democracy and representative democracy, and I'll be talking about democratic deliberation. And I don't mean by that kind of broad participation, I mean very specific, robustly designed methodologies like citizens' juries and citizens' panels, which seek to bring representative groups together to engage fully with the evidence around a particular issue, hearing from all sides, and then to reach a judgment. So in a sense, the political equivalent of a jury that would be used in a trial. And what is interesting to me, actually, is that one of our few institutions that hasn't suffered reputational damage is the jury system, because people still believe, well, I would probably have made that decision had it been me. But yet, if you look at the history of of attempt to bring that kind of robust deliberation into our democracy to complement direct democracy and representative democracy, what you see is it's sporadic, it's occasional, it's marginal. There's a big new experiment I think the House is taking forward around a citizens panel to look at social care, an initiative in the next few weeks, I think. But it's one-off. It's not integrated within our kind of unwritten constitution. And I tried when I was in government, to get Blair and then people around Gordon Brown tried to do the same thing, to get proper, well-constituted citizens' juries. But then the view was, well, we can't control the outcome, so it's all a bit dangerous. Are you a fan of democratic deliberation? And if so, what can we do to take it from the occasional and the exotic and the marginal and say, no, actually, it should be an integral part of a good democracy?
So I'm not sure I'd agree that we don't do it now. I mean, I'm constantly, as a cabinet member, signing off on consultations. And very often, as Secretary of State for DEFRA, on things like, the future for agricultural subsidies, the future for, preventing elephant poaching, all of these things, we would gather together stakeholders, so people who are in NGOs or people who are interested, young people, people in the business, in the antiques trade, in the case of ivory poaching, and we would gather them together and seek their views, and it would be quite a sort of, structured meeting to be able to take the temperature of people who know something about it. So if you're talking about people who specifically know nothing about it, so that you can raise issues with them, give them a bit of knowledge, and then get their sort of totally unbiased, disinterested view, then that, I think, probably is a fair criticism. But government, as part of our democratic engagement and our legislative process, we consult on everything. I mean, in many ways, it's one of the frustrations. People say to me, this is wrong, fix it. And I say to them, well, actually, that would take about 2 years because we'd have to do this and that and consult, and then we'd have to respond to the consultation, and then we'd have to do primary legislation and then secondary. And people don't get that. They don't understand how long it takes to change the law. So anything that puts further barriers in the way of actually achieving things, I think, isn't an unmitigated good, to be honest with you.
So, and this really will be my penultimate question before I open up, but actually I would argue it's the absolute reverse of that, which is that I think that if you use proper deliberation, and I find it very interesting because you're very clearly thinking deeply about these issues, but actually I would say that stakeholder engagement, the engagement of people with vested interests, the engagement of people who've got the capacity to lobby and to mobilise, is completely different to the idea of citizen engagement, where you're engaging disinterested citizens and seeing what judgments they reach. And actually, far from standing in the way of change, I think it would allow change. So, for example, I was talking to somebody the other day in the National Infrastructure Commission who was saying, look, everybody knows sooner or later we'll have road pricing. But the fact is, politicians won't kind of go there because it's just a bit too worrying. If you gather 30 citizens in a room together and you say, look, this is the reality. If you want roads, they've got to be paid for. Who should pay for them? The people who use them. And that will also mean that people don't use them when they need to. Almost certainly those citizens, the vast majority, if they heard all the evidence, would say, no, that's what you need to do and get on with it. Mm. So in some ways, deliberation could empower politicians to make braver choices by demonstrating the journey that ordinary citizens go on if they hear the evidence put to them. But still, as I say, we do it so rarely.
So, I mean, again, we do consult widely, and that's not force, that's people need to choose to take part. But the other thing governments do very often is focus groups, and that is exactly what you're talking about, where they take people who have no specific interest in the subject and they gather them together and they trial things on them to see how something will land. So that, I think, I mean, it may simply be that you're coming at it from a more academic sort of, cerebral perspective, but from a practical perspective, what you find in government is that everything government does has kind of been road tested, both with people who do have vested interests, but also with people who don't, just to find out whether this is kind of general, received wisdom and people think it's a good idea or not. And I could, we could go into lots of examples of where, as a result of focus groups, it's been decided not to do something because people are just like, that would be stupid. So I think in terms of vetoing policy, it's very much a useful tool that governments use a lot.
So finally, we spoke before we came in about the whips and the way the whips work, and I was talking about that play our house, about how the whips operation used to be and the culture that used to be there. You've done great work to challenge that culture of bullying and intimidation. kind of interested, what do you think are the longer term implications of that changing? Because that has been so much, that capacity of the whips in particular to strong arm people has been a really important part of how our system kind of works. What happens in a house where people are nice to each other? Does it shift? Is it just the old system, but we're polite about it? Or does it actually shift something more fundamental about things like party discipline, for example?
So I think there's two things there. In terms of the independent complaints procedure, I genuinely think that's going to fundamentally change the culture of Parliament, and it will be a much nicer place to work in future. Because as everyone here would expect, being disinterested people, 80% of the problem is the kind of general bullying, not letting someone go to lunch, not letting them go home, asking them to go and get your dry cleaning for you, why should I? That sort of bad, just generally nasty workplace behaviour, coming down to sort of shouting at you and swearing at you and leaving you thoroughly miserable and hating your job, which you thought was your dream job. And that, I think, the complaints procedure, you know, ranging all the way up to much more serious complaints, I think that will change the culture, because there will be real sanctions and people will have a safe place to go and make that complaint and have justice seen to be done with, in the form of an apology, or MP is forced to go on a training course, or other such sort of awkward things that will then change the behaviour. So that, I think, Parliament will become a nicer place as a result of this new independent complaints procedure. But your other point about the whipping and so on, I think that play, I'm sure some of you would have seen it, this House, which was all about in the 70s and the really bullying approach taken by the whips. And I would actually say that the procedures in Parliament changed, I think actually in 2009 as a result of the Right Commission, which meant that in future all positions on select committees would be elected rather than appointed. And it's extraordinary how what that did was it took away many of the whips' ability to give you a favour in return for you just do as you're told. And so actually I think my experience, I mean, I came in as an MP in 2010 and I've never found that kind of this House experience. And I think a lot of that is down to the fact that there just aren't the kind of the things to hold over you any longer. So I genuinely think that Parliament is a better place from what I hear, but as I wasn't there previously, I can't swear to it. But I think the complaints procedure is going to change things radically for the better.
Well, thank you. What I'll try to do is take a couple of rounds of questions. If you could try and keep the question brief, and if you could tell us your name, that would be great. And there are roving microphones so that we can record your comments for posterity. And there are immediately two hands here.
Hi, my name's Dan Dunleavy. For 11 years, I lived in Maidenhead, and it was a very safe Tory seat. We know who occupied it, and she's currently the Prime Minister. I now live in Regent's Park, which is a very safe Labour seat, which was occupied by Frank Dobson and is now occupied by Keir Starmer. I have had the right to participate in a voting process, but for the last 22 years, I haven't really had that much influence over the outcome. And I don't really want to sort of make a cheap shot about proportional representation, because I know that's a hornet's nest in its own right. But in a sense, my vote has counted for nothing. And there are others in this country who are in a similar situation. And I think that undermines commitment to effective democracy. I just would like to know what you think.
We'll take two or three together, if that's all right. Yep.
Name's Alec Charles. Touching on the points you made, especially, if you gather a citizens jury panel, whatever you want to call them, surely you're only appealing to those people, such as in this room, who are engaged. How on earth do you reach the people that aren't engaged or are just interested in shouting their mouth off on social media? How on earth do you reach them?
And, yep, Derek.
I'm Derek Bates. I want to raise an issue which doesn't have an answer. Progressively, the West is taken over by China. We've taken several decades deciding whether to have a third runway in Heathrow. In something like 10 years, China builds 35 airports. We're faced with losing our virility because we haven't got any way of opposing the Chinese machine.
So I think think how it feels to be a voter in a place where your vote, where the votes are weighed rather than counted, as it were. I'll respond to your point, because unusually it was presented slightly more to me, but I'm sure Andrew might want to as well. And then, you know, isn't parliamentary democracy and all of that, in the end, it's putting us in the slow lane in comparison to authoritarian systems that can just get on with it?
Well, in answer to your point, I'm a big fan of first past the post, because the problem with any other system is you end up with the lowest common denominator. You end up with the person that the least number of people didn't like, and that cannot either be right. But the one thing I would say to you in terms of sort of a light at the end of the tunnel is we've had some seismic shifts in voting shares. So you might be providing one of the very safest Conservative seats and one of the very safest Labour seats. I suspect you possibly are pinpointing those two. For most people, it's not quite as black and white as that. It is much more nuanced, and we have seen some big upsets. And I think actually that in itself is a big argument for voting, is to always not think, well, it won't count, it won't make a difference, but to actually, you know, always put your X in the box. But fundamentally, first past the post, I believe, is the best system. And it enables you to throw out a government. I mean, look at the frustration in, for example, Germany recently, where they simply can't form a government because this coalition thing is so extraordinarily difficult. So that's my opinion. In terms of the how do you reach out to people, honestly, people say that MPs live in a bubble. We don't. We go and talk to our constituents. We reach out to people. I can absolutely assure you, I know what voters across Northamptonshire think, whether they live in a council house, whether they're in a student flat, whether they are an elderly person in a bungalow or a multimillionaire living in a 12-bedroom house. I go and knock on their doors and find out what they think. So that is the best way to reach out to people and get their views. And I don't actually, I agree with you, I'm not sure that a citizen's jury is necessarily going to give you that same insight that we receive. And I do feel it's a little unfair that MPs are accused of just living in a bubble. I mean, in our surgeries too, we see some of the most difficult challenges faced by human beings on the planet in our surgeries, and I could bore for Britain about some of the cases. To your point, sir, about China, I would have to very respectfully disagree with you. I actually think, for me, the UK is absolutely in pole position to take advantage of the fourth industrial revolution. If you look at some of the legislation we're bringing forward on spaceflight, to be the European centre for commercial spaceflight launches and for satellite launches, and we're putting in place a regulatory environment to enable us to take advantage of that. On automated vehicles, we aim to be, you know, we've got the Faraday Institute looking at battery technology. We've got extraordinary, we're the centre for Facebook and Google in Europe. We've got amazing game technology, artificial intelligence, robotics, even down to sort of automated fruit picking. The UK is absolutely in pole position to take advantage of innovation as it comes through. If you look at that, if you contrast that with China, you're absolutely right, they can build airports in absolute double quick time. But they also have a challenge. They have 300 million middle-class consumers, and they don't like their water quality, their soil quality, their animal husbandry, their regulations, the environment that they live in, the pollution, etc., etc. They look to the extraordinary achievements of our food and animal husbandry quality in the West. So they will be big consumers of our products. They will be fantastic markets for us in the future.
I'll take some more questions. I'm not going to preempt my speech or hijack the event. I refer you to the work that we did around what we call the Citizens Economic Council, which took a group of ordinary citizens in London and Manchester who knew nothing about economics, and over an 18-month period, they developed the capacity to understand economic issues and come up with interesting ideas, so much that, in the end, the chief economist of the Bank of England said he was going to set up citizens' panels in each Bank of England regional area in order to get that citizen input. And you know, having been involved in frontline politics myself, what I would say about ordinary citizens is never overestimate their knowledge, but never underestimate their common sense. So if you can get a genuinely representative group of citizens, their capacity, when they're given the information, to reach wise judgment is incredible. But we don't use those kind of processes very often. Okay, so let me take 1, 2, 3 as our second round of questions. Thank you.
Good evening, Andrea. My name's Robbie, and I'm a huge fan, first of all. I'd like to ask you about religion and faith, if I may. And as a Christian in Parliament, do you feel that all members of Parliament, whatever their faith, can celebrate it openly? and what measures are in place to ensure that they can.
Thank you. And then Rob's
I'm Robert Harris. Good evening. One of the realities of democracy is that when you have a result at an election or a referendum, there are going to be large numbers of people who actually are very uncomfortable with that result. That's the reality. And we've had two very significant results in the last couple of years, one in America and the referendum here, where large numbers of people not only are unhappy with the result, but they appear to be very defiant and they refuse to accept the result. And it seems to me, I would suggest, that democracy is rather more fragile than we think.
Thank you. And then finally?
I had a question. My name's Sarah McDonald. Not to hammer on about voting systems, but I had a question about... So in Scotland, we have a combined voting system where you have first-past-the-post and single transferable vote. Do you think the possibility of not a complete overhaul of our voting system across the UK, but potentially examining the possibility of mixed voting systems where you keep the good stuff but you maybe have a chance of integrating other parts in would ever be a possibility, and just what your thoughts were on that?
So if you could take those questions, Andrew, and then we'll wind up. Thank you.
So thank you, Robbie. And I just worry that my special advisors might wrestle me to the ground if I ever say anything about God or faith ever again in my entire life. Not that I'm intimidated at all, you understand, but I have been burned slightly on this subject. So I do think it's a big challenge. And I think, you know, last week we've seen the appalling abuse of people for being Jewish. And we've also seen horrible Islamophobia. And we also actually do regularly see people being absolutely ridiculed for being Christian. And I myself have my own experience. So I do think that it's very important to be tolerant towards people. But I equally think that in the public space, it's very important to be mutually respectful, but not to push one's faith in other people's faces, if I can put it like that. I've learnt my lesson very well, I think, there. Quick learner. And then to your question, which was a brilliant one, about people not wanting to accept election results or indeed referendum results. You know, this really goes to the heart of what I was trying to say, is that our public spaces, the debate is coarsening and people are sort of feeling it's fine to just kind of trash somebody else because they don't agree with them. And that's the really at the nub of what I think is going wrong. And so I think one of the things we really have to do as politicians, and I do try and do this, and I admit to being totally imperfect in this regard, is to never be triumphalist about things. So, you know, whilst I can be very delighted about the result of the referendum, I don't want to throw that down anyone else's throat, and I always want to respect their views. As Matthew asked me earlier, do I, what was it you said, this enemy of the people? Yeah. I don't accept any of that, absolutely don't. And, you know, some of my colleagues who massively regret the decision taken at the EU referendum, I will massively give them respect and time to listen to their views. I think that's incredibly important. I think it's not just about politicians, however, it's also about the media. And unfortunately, you know, the media do an incredibly important role, and I will always argue for freedom of the press, but the reality is they exist to sell newspapers, not to promote, you know, democracy or this particular political position and so on. And we have to remember that. And so I do also think that we all do slightly fall. You know, my mum's always saying to me, is this true? And I'm like, of course not. Do you really think that's true? She's like, oh, yeah, of course, it wouldn't be true, would it? But we all just believe what we read. I mean, I get emails through telling me that, you know, an illegal immigrant gets, you know, £3,000 a week and a beautiful luxury pad in Mayfair to live in whilst a pensioner is left on the streets. And I just reply to them saying, do you really think that that's the case? You know, you're sending to me, asking me to justify this. Of course it's not true. So I do think there is a problem where we do tend to believe what we read. We allow things to sort of scale up and to amplify, and then we get really, really angry about things. So I don't know what the answer is, but I absolutely recognise the problem. And, you know, I just think anybody with, you know, a good heart and a decent brain should always be sceptical about what they read in the papers. I mean, when I go and talk to university students, I say to them, if you see something that's out there that, you know, for example, the Tories don't believe that animals feel pain, think to yourself, Is that likely to be true? You know, bearing in mind Tories, we have our dogs and we love our dogs. Why would Tories think that animals don't feel pain? So don't just take that at face value. Go and do your research. Go and find out, is that actually what happened, or is in fact there more to this story than meets the eye? And that's really the thing, is we all need to be healthily sceptical and not just believe everything that we see. That's probably a really bad answer, but that is how I feel about it. And then can you just remind me what was...
I guess the question is, haven't they cracked it in Scotland, where you do have a constituency MP, and we do have, you know, we have strong, you know, we have strong governments there, but we have fewer people in this gentleman's position of their vote being irrelevant.
Yes. So I've actually recently been to visit the presiding officer in Scotland and to talk about how the Scottish Parliament works, and it was absolutely fascinating. But I must admit, I was very slightly horrified by the fact that you, in effect, have 8 MPs in every constituency. I was like, I'm not sure people in England would welcome that. You know, one is more than enough for most of them. So, I mean, yes, of course, we will always keep electoral systems under review. But what we're trying to do in England is to reduce, you know, in Westminster, I should say, is to reduce the number of members of Parliament, and certainly the idea that you've got your list system and your local Member of Parliament does, to me, on the face of it, look a little bit excessive. But I do accept your point that then you can sort of get your representative in more ways than one, and then you can perhaps have a wider choice of people to represent you. But I actually also think in Westminster we perhaps don't use the peers as much as we could do. You know, peers live all around the United Kingdom, would be very happy to take up specific interests of constituents, and I actually would encourage everyone to go and bother their local lord or baroness and stop bothering me. That might be my message. Yeah.
Well, we've come to an end. If you want to know more about the case I'll be making in a few weeks' time for Deliberative Democracy and demonstrating it's not focus groups and it's not consultation, but it's returning to some of the core ideas of democracy, then look at the RSA website. We'll be publicising that and the campaign for Deliberative Democracy that we intend to launch. But that's in the future. Tonight we've had a great speech. We had a fantastic conversation. So please join me in thanking the Leader of the House of Commons, Andrea Leadsom.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.